We gather in sacred place. We feel a holy presence. The light of truth shines in through the clear glass windows. Songs of faith resound within these walls. We share a sacred time. We pause for Sabbath rest. This hour invites us to refresh our spirit. The company of fellow seekers enriches our discovery. Enter the space. Share the time. Find the sacred and the true. Each week we begin our service by symbolically bringing a spark that burns in each of us together to light our common flame. And to light our chalice, this fall we've been asking various different groups in the church to come forward, members, so that you may get to know them in case you want information about them or know who serves in what capacity. And today the membership, a couple of members of the membership committee will be coming up to do that. As they light the chalice, I invite you to join in the words of A. Powell Davies that are printed in your order of service for chalice lighting. There is a kindly light that leads the wanderer through the wilderness. When there is nothing else, there is this. And the fearful soul, beset with doubts, wavering and faltering, can still follow this light. It did not come from nowhere. No light does. It is the gift to every honest pilgrim who, having left behind the faith that has failed, sets forth anew, knowing not where the path may lead. This fall, our children are exploring Hebrew scripture and the Hebrew tradition, and many of the stories they encounter are about people we call prophets. Well, one of the most famous prophets in that tradition is Elijah. He's really a feisty prophet, always telling the people where they've gone wrong. You know, these prophet guys are pretty intense people. A friend of mine used to say, they're not the folks you like to invite to your house for a dinner party. Well, there are many stories about Elijah. But today we meet Elijah at a point where he has a problem. No matter how much he preaches to them, he just can't keep the Israelites in line. Many have turned away from their one God, the God Elijah works for, and are worshiping a number of gods, especially the god called Baal. All Hebrew prophets are telling the Israelites that they're in big trouble for this, and many of the prophets get killed for doing so. In fact, Elijah is about the only one left, and he doesn't know what to do. He decides to impress the people with a contest between the two gods to show that his God is the one true God, the powerful one. And he believes that will make the people come back to their religion. Well, the contest takes place. The people call out to the god Baal to come and show his strength and power. But nothing happens. Elijah calls to his God and says something like this. Look, I'm doing your work. I really need your help. You sent me to do this job, but things have not been going well. So the God of Elijah does show up and does some pretty impressive stuff and clearly wins the contest. And you would think Elijah would be a hero, and everyone would stop believing in Baal and go back to their faith. But the plan doesn't work. Instead of coming back to their faith, they get angry at Elijah. And the wicked queen Jezebel even orders him to be killed, and he flees for his life. Elijah's had it. Nothing's gone right. He's all alone. He's at the end of his rope. He really needs a break, maybe a different job. He's failed at everything. He's about the only prophet left, and he is giving up. He just wants to die. Well, he walks a long way, and he finally reaches the mount called Horeb, which is the mountain of God, and he climbs up it and into a cave up near the top, and he falls asleep. And he hears a voice ask him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He believes the question comes from his God, and he thought, after all that he's gone through, it's kind of a dumb question, but he answers, I'm not sure what I'm doing here. I'm very scared and frustrated. I defended you and won a contest that proved you were the one true God, stronger than the god Baal. Even so, there are still many who do not believe in your power, and many refuse to keep their covenant with you. And Jezebel, that mean queen, is after me. She's angry that I won the contest. Now I'm afraid for my life, and I don't know what to do. The voice spoke again, telling Elijah to go out of the cave, to the mouth of the cave, and stand there. And Elijah did what he was asked to do. He came out of the cave and he stood atop Mount Horeb, hoping that he might feel his God's presence and understand what on earth to do next. Suddenly, a very powerful wind whipped around the mountains, breaking off huge pieces of rock, which came crashing down. But Elijah didn't hear the voice of God, his God, in the wind. It wasn't there. Then a terrible earthquake came. The mountain shook ferociously, but God was not in the earthquake. And then came a terrible fire, with big flames whipping around the mountain. But Elijah knew his God wasn't in the fire either. And after the fire, it was quiet. And then, in the calm, Elijah heard a still, small voice. And he was transformed. He was not afraid anymore. He got the courage to go and lead the people again. He came down from the mountain and continued his work. You see, up to this point, Elijah has always thought of his God as a super powerful, always making himself known in the showy stuff. But now he meets a God as a little voice that speaks inside him, helping him to do the right thing, helping him not to be afraid anymore. Elijah's story is pretty wild. But you know, if we can be quiet and listen inside our heads, we can sometimes hear that still small voice just like Elijah did. And it can help us. It can give us courage or show us the way when we're confused. So to our children and youth who are soon to leave us, this week I want you to think about, if you can remember a time in your life when a voice inside you spoke to you. I'd like to share with you a poem by Mary Oliver titled The Journey. One day, you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Today I get to preach on two of my favorite texts. They are texts that I turn to as part of my spiritual practice and on which, over time, I have reflected at some length. They've helped me to grow in my self-understanding and my theology. Usually I draw on them separately for different messages, but I think they have something important in common, and that's where I want to go with you today. The poem, The Journey, by Mary Oliver is one of my very favorite poems and always speaks to me in a deeply spiritual way. It has an important place in my life because it first spoke to me when I was transitioning from being a lawyer to being a minister. It perfectly described the situation of my life at that time and I believe gave me the push and the strength I needed to take the big step and do the thing I knew I needed to do. It is a poem about hearing the still small voice within and following its guide. And the story about Elijah from the first book of Kings that I shared as our message for all ages this morning has been equally important in my spiritual life. In that story, we encounter a very different idea of God from the prevailing idea of that time and even for many today. Up to that point in the story, Elijah and the Israelites have depended upon the show-off God of wind and earthquake and fire, an almighty, all-powerful, anthropomorphic being who shouts out with anger and harsh judgment. He's the one that Elijah called upon in that contest to do his stuff. But there's a radical shift in the idea of God in that story. At this time of crisis in his life, where he has had it up to here, he's at the end of his rope, not knowing where to turn or what to do next, Elijah no longer finds his God in the big, almighty stuff, but instead in the calm, in the power of silence, of inward listening. God is not made known to Elijah in spectacular ways. but is manifested as a voice of conscience. The voice gives Elijah the strength to go on. It gives his life new meaning, and he is transformed. He goes forth to lead his people again. This idea of God as an indwelling voice or an inner guiding light is not new in our tradition. The late A. Powell Davies described it, as we read in our chalice lighting words this morning, as a kindly light that leads the wanderer through the wilderness. When there is nothing else, there is this. And the fearful soul, beset with doubts, wavering and faltering, can still follow this light. It's the gift to every honest pilgrim who, having left behind the faith that has failed, sets forth anew, not knowing where the path may lead. In fact, that is the story of our tradition. In the early 1800s, William Ellery Channing preached that the role of religion was to help us to connect to the spark of the divine that is in each of us. Ralph Waldo Emerson and his transcendentalist buddies taught that we know God intuitively, not from miraculous flashy events, not from secondhand information found in Scripture, but through the direct reception of beautiful sentiment and from the still small voice within us. We're not alone in experiencing connecting to the inner light or the inner voice that comes to us in silence. It's found in many other religious traditions, from Quakers to Buddhists. A few years ago, our UCC brothers and sisters launched a growth campaign and printed large red banners with the slogan, "God is still speaking." You still see them hanging on some of their churches. For me, and I think for many of them, it expressed this idea that religion is not really about following ancient biblical mandates or looking for miraculous encounters, but is about listening for the deep words of truth within us. Both the story of Elijah and Mary Oliver's poem attribute experiences of profound transformation, restoration, new direction, renewal, whatever it may be, as coming from listening to a small voice that comes out of the quiet. Whose words are they? Where do they come from? Mary Oliver suggests that they are our own words. The Elijah story suggests it's God speaking. You decide for yourself. But either way, hearing the voice is a profound experience that changes lives. I believe every one of us, theists or atheists, humanists, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, whatever, can have the same experience. Perhaps the poet and prophets connect to it more easily, but it's available to each of us. For some of us, this is a very mystical experience, and some of us may see it through a rational, psychological lens. But either way, we still know it. We know it has power, even power that can save us. And I also think we all know something else. We all know the experience that led up to this for Elijah and for that unknown person in Mary Oliver's poem. Maybe lots of bad advice voices shouting at us, wild and sleepless nights, rocky roads with fallen branches, and Mary Oliver's words. I suspect we have all found ourselves at times in Elijah's place, suffering from overwork that is not going well, very stressed at trying to prove our worth, tired, never seeming able to get it right, to do enough, to be good enough, burnt out. It can happen in our jobs. It can happen in our personal lives and in our homes. It can even happen here at church. I worry that some of you who work so hard to get this incredible construction project done may feel a bit like Elijah, caught up in the whirlwind of doing, maybe not feeling totally appreciated, even losing sight of what this place is all about and what your spirit needs here, wondering what's next. Unlike Elijah, our project was very successful. But I know I was feeling the stress of all that had to be done and finding it hard to connect to the deeper place within me. And I'm sure I wasn't alone. Our lives are full of all sorts of voices calling us in all sorts of directions. Some of them are voices from inside, and some of them are voices from outside. As Frederick Buechner put it, the more alive and alert we are, the more clamorous our lives are. The question is always, which voices do we listen to? Some are very loud and can drown out the inner voice, the still, small voice. We need to retreat, to go to the quiet place, the place of calm, and listen to the voice that comes out to us from silence. Listening for this voice is perhaps the essential spiritual practice of our lives. If I were to ask you to think about a time when you heard this voice, I bet you would tell me it was in a time of quiet. A time perhaps when you were away or in a place that was renewing to your spirit. Or maybe it was in the middle of the night. Or maybe it was in an intentional time of prayer or meditation. Yes, sometimes we do perhaps get hit like a brick with words, but most often we have to make ourselves open for those important words and invite them in. Now, many of you know that I was a lawyer for much of my life and comes up regularly in sermons. And many of you have asked, and I have partially answered at times, what caused me to make the switch? Well, today you get the full answer. In the latter part of that career, I was a bit burnt out with trial work, trials nearly every day. Now, don't get me wrong, I loved the law, but I knew that there was something else for me. And in my mid-40s, in the words of Mary Oliver, I knew it was already late, and I was actively listening for what was next for me. I was involved in a Unitarian Universalist church and had many times considered going into the ministry, even checked out divinity schools. But it was sort of a far-off idea, a maybe that was floating on the horizon. I continued to practice law and sometimes did pro bono work on cases referred by various agencies. Well, one of those agencies, AIDS Project Worcester, called me and asked if I would represent a client of theirs who was charged with assault and battery. I'd handled hundreds of A and B cases, as they're called, and said sure, thinking this would be a piece of cake. But then I thought, that's not the kind of legal matter for which this agency was ordinarily seeking help. Usually they were discrimination cases or assistance with wills and estate planning for those terminally ill. But in any event, I said I would. So I told them to call my secretary and set up an appointment for the individual to come to my office. They hesitated and said, well, we'll have to see if hospice can bring him to you. A person in hospice care charged with assault and battery. I began to wonder what I got myself into. Well, the man was in fact brought to my office, and it was a very sad sight. He was just skin and bones and walked with great effort. He was very ill, but still there was a determination about him. I reviewed the complaint and his paperwork and asked him to explain to me what had happened. He told me an incredible story. You see, he lived in a house in a small central Massachusetts town with his partner, who had just recently died of AIDS. They lived next door to the daughter of a local politician, who had some influence and who hated the fact that she had two gay men living next door to her and hated even more that these two men had AIDS. She harassed them. And on the day his partner died, she was outside their home banging on the house with a stick and shouting anti-gay hateful words. He came out of the house and waved a stick at her and then went back in. The partner died, and he was buried in a cemetery just down the road from their home. The neighbor was so hateful that she took a wheelbarrow of garbage and dumped it on the fresh grave. She didn't stop there. She went to the courthouse with some influence and alleged that my client chased her and hit her with the stick. And she managed to get a complaint issued against him. Now, it shouldn't have happened without a hearing where my client was present, but who knows, maybe he got notice of it and all that was going on in his life didn't get to the hearing. But the complaint did issue. And so he was summoned to court to answer criminal assault and battery charges brought by this woman. That's where I come into the picture. He had no record, no criminal record. He had never been in trouble. And as he sat in front of my desk and looked at how frail he was, I thought I was quite sure that a conference with the DA and the judge could get rid of this matter, that this could be dropped. I told him that I thought I could take care of this without him having to go through the strain of a trial. But to my surprise, he told me he didn't want that. He said he wanted to fight it in court. I said that I was concerned that he wasn't up to it. And he replied, he didn't care if he died in the courtroom. He had to do this. Reluctantly, I agreed. And we set the case for trial. That day, he could barely walk into the courtroom. And frankly, I was very uneasy as I sat next to him. But thankfully, the trial did not last long. The woman's hate and lies became obvious as she testified, and the judge took a recess, called the attorneys into chambers, and suggested that the DA agree to a not guilty finding, and if the woman protested, he would issue charges against her instead. So we went back into court. The judge harshly admonished the woman and found my client not guilty. We left the courtroom, and my client thanked me. But what he said still rings in my ears. He said, "You're a good lawyer, but you have been more like a minister to me." It hit me like a brick. As I drove home, a voice in my head kept saying those words, "You're more like a minister than a lawyer. You're more like a minister than a lawyer." That night, I heard those words in my dreams again and again. And I also heard the word yes. I tried to dismiss them at first. I spoke with friends, all who thought I would be crazy to even consider leaving a good law practice. My law partner insisted it was a midlife crisis and suggested I buy an expensive sports car and get over it. My spiritual practice, even at that time, included reading passages of scripture and poetry, and I would fumble around with books that I had and notes for things that might speak to me on a particular day. And a few days after the trial, I opened Mary Oliver's book, Dream Work, and I read, I think for the first time, these words. "One day, you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. I knew what I had to do. I applied to Harvard Divinity School, fully expecting not to be accepted that year. But within a few weeks, I got her a letter of acceptance. It had an option to delay it a year, but the voice inside me said no. And in a matter of months, I settled things with my law partner and was off to be a minister. Whenever I think about Elijah hearing the still small voice, whenever I read Mary Oliver's poems, I think back to this time in my life. And in truth, there have been other times too, often times of struggle, when a voice of strength or of wisdom came from within me. In these situations, it was more than me talking to myself. You may call it something else, but I think of it as the voice of God. But not the God of fire and earthquakes and battles, but the indwelling voice of conscience and courage. I suppose it's there all the time, but it takes extraordinary circumstances, I think, to be in the place where you hear it clearly. When I talk with others about their profound spiritual experiences in their life, they share many of the same characteristics of mine. They were in a struggle like Elijah. Maybe they were struggling with medical issues. Maybe they had a profound encounter with another person. Or perhaps they had experienced just the calm and the beauty of a special place. Something had opened their inner ears to this voice. Now, some of those people were devout Christians. Some of those people are Buddhists. Some of those people are humanists. I believe the experience of this still small voice is universally available. My hope is that we'll all take the time in our lives to listen for the voice. From all the fret and fever of the day, let there be moments when we turn away and deaf to all the confusing outer din, intently listen to the voice within.